They want to help us, Mom.
A communist, Elsa said slowly, trying to process this new and dangerous information.
They want to help us fight the growers.
Fight the growers? You mean the people who employ us? The people who pay us to pick their crops?
You call that pay?
It is pay, Loretta. It buys us the food we eat.
I want you to come to a meeting with me.
A meeting?
Yes. Just listen to him. You'll like what...
No, Loretta, Elsa said. Absolutely not. I am not going, and I forbid you to go. The people you met are dangerous.
But...
Believe me, Loretta, whatever the question is, communism is not the answer. We're Americans, and we can't get on the wrong side of the growers. We're close enough to starvation as it is, so... No.
But it's the right thing.
Look at this tent, Loretta. Do you think we have the luxury of fighting our employers? Do you think we have the luxury of waging a philosophical war? No. Just no. And I don't want to hear about it again. Now, come. Let's get a little sleep. I'm exhausted. Rain fell for days. The land along the ditch bank became a pond. People started getting sick. Typhoid, diphtheria, dysentery. The burying ground doubled in size. Because the county hospital refused to treat most of the migrants, they had to help themselves as best they could. Everyone was hungry and lethargic. Elsa spent as little as she possibly could on food, and still she watched their savings dwindle. On this stormy winter night, Loretta and Aunt were in bed, trying to sleep, burrowed beneath a pile of quilts. Rain hammered the canvas, rippled the grayed fabric, and sluiced down the sides. Elsa sat on an apple crate, writing in her journal by the meager light of a single candle. For most of my life, weather was a thing remarked upon by the old men in their dusty hats who stopped to jaw with each other outside Walcott Tractor Supply. A topic of conversation. Farmers studied the sky the way a priest read the word of God, looking for clues and signs and warnings. But all of it from a friendly distance, all of it with a faith in the essential kindness of our planet. But in this terrible decade, the weather has proven itself to be cruel, an adversary that we underestimated at our peril. Wind, dust, drought, and now this demoralizing rain, I fear. Thunder exploded in a deafening crack.
That was a bad one, Loretta said.
Aunt looked scared. Elsa closed her journal and got up. She was halfway to the flaps when the tent collapsed around them. Water rushed in, sucked at Elsa's legs. She shoved her journal in the bodice of her dress and reached out blindly for her children. Kids, come to me! She heard them clawing at the wet canvas, trying to find their way. I'm here, Elsa said. Loretta reached her, held her hand, kept one arm around her brother. We have to get out, Elsa said, fighting to find the tent flaps. Aunt was crying beside her, clinging to her. Hang on to me, Elsa shouted to him. She found the split in the fabric, wrenched the flaps open, stumbled out with the children. The tent whooshed past them, taking their belongings with it. The money. A gush of water hit Elsa so hard she almost fell. Lightning flashed. In the light, she saw utter destruction. Garbage and leaves and wooden crates floated past, riding the torrent, there and gone in a second. Holding tightly to her children's hands, she slogged against the rising tide of water and made her way to the Dewey's tent.
Jean! Jeb!
The tent collapsed just as the Deweys crawled out. The sound of people screaming rose above the howl of the storm. Elsa saw headlights out on the road, turning, coming their way. She spat rain, pushed the wet hair out of her eyes, and yelled,
"We need to go that way, toward the road!"
The two families stayed close together, all holding hands. Elsa's boots filled with muddy water. She knew her children were barefoot in this cold, wet water. Together, they fought their way toward the headlights. There was a row of cars parked on the main road, headlights pointed at the camp. Halfway there, Elsa saw a line of people with flashlights. A tall man stepped forward, wearing a brown canvas duster and a hat that sagged in the rain.
"This way, ma'am," he yelled. "We're here to help you."
The Deweys made it to the row of volunteers. Elsa saw someone hand Jean a raincoat. Elsa looked back. Their tent was gone now, washed away, but the truck was still there. If she didn't get it now, she would lose it. She pushed her children forward.
"Go,"
she said. "I have to get the truck."
"No, Mom, you can't,"
Loretta shouted. Rushing water tried to push Elsa over. She pulled Aunt's wet hand out of hers and shoved him at Loretta.
"Get yourselves to safety." "No, Mom!"
Elsa saw the tall volunteer heading their way again. She pushed her children toward the man, said,
"Save them,"
and turned back.
"Ma'am, you can't!"
Elsa fought her way to the truck, which was running board deep in water. A plastic doll in a muddy pink dress floated by, blue marble eyes staring upward. Mud and water had swept their campsite away. Everything was gone. The stove had been knocked over, water swirled over it. She thought about the box that held their money and knew she'd never find it. She climbed into the truck, grateful for once that she kept the keys in the glove box. Auto theft was low on anyone's mind when gas was unaffordable.
"Please start."
Elsa turned the key in the ignition. It took 5 tries and 5 prayers before the truck grumbled and groaned and came to life. She turned on the headlights and put the truck in gear. The truck jostled from side to side, fighting its way out of the mud. Elsa kept her hands tight on the wheel. Her feet worked the pedals. The vehicle rolled and bucked, and sometimes the engine whined, but finally the tires found purchase. Elsa drove slowly out to the road, where a string of volunteers helped people into cars. She saw Loretta step out of an old-fashioned, wooden-cabbed truck into the pouring rain and wave her hands in the air.
"Follow us, Mom!"
Elsa followed the old truck into Welty. On a small, deserted street by the railroad tracks, it pulled up in front of a boarded-up hotel. On either side of the hotel were businesses that had been shut down, a Mexican restaurant and a laundry and a bakery. The streetlights were off. A shuttered gas station boasted a hand-lettered sign that read, "This is your country. Don't let the big men take it away from you." Elsa had never seen this street. It was several blocks from the main section of Welty. The few houses she could see looked dilapidated and deserted. She pulled up alongside the other truck and parked. She stepped out into the driving rain. Her children immediately ran to her. She drew them in close, holding them tightly, shivering.
"Where are the Deweys?"
Elsa yelled to be heard over the storm.
"They left with other volunteers."
The driver of the truck stepped out. At first, all she noticed was his height and the familiarity of the dark brown duster he wore. It was an old-fashioned coat, something a cowboy would wear. She'd seen it before somewhere. He walked toward Elsa through the headlights' rain-beaded glare. It came to her. She'd seen him spouting communist rhetoric in town once, and again outside the jail, where he'd been beaten on the night Loretta ran away.
"The jailbird," she said.
"The warrior," he answered. "I'm Jack Vallon. Come, let's get you warm."
"He's the communist I met, Mom,"
Loretta said.
"Yes," Elsa said. "I've seen him in town."
He led them to the padlocked hotel door and put a key in the lock. The big black lock clattered to the side. He pushed the door open.
"Wait, the hotel looks boarded up," Elsa said. "Looks can be deceiving. In fact, we count on that," Jack said. "A friend owns this place. It only looks abandoned. We keep it boarded up for... well, never mind. You can have 1 or 2 nights here. I wish it could be more."
"We are grateful for anything,"
Elsa said, shivering.
"Your friends, the Deweys, were taken to the abandoned Grange Hall. We are doing what we can. It came on so suddenly. There will be more help in place in the morning."
"From communists?"
"I don't see anyone else here, do you?"
He led them inside the small hotel, which smelled of decay and cigarette smoke and must. It took Elsa's eyes a moment to adjust. She saw a burgundy desk with a wall of brass keys behind it. She followed Jack up to the second floor. There, he opened a door to reveal a small, dusty room with a large canopy bed, a pair of nightstands, and a closed door. He walked past them into the room and opened the closed door.
"A bathroom," Elsa whispered.
"There's hot water," he said. "Warm, at least."
Aunt and Loretta shrieked and ran for the shower. Elsa heard them turn it on.
"Come on, Mom!"
Jack looked at Elsa.
"Do you have a name besides Mom?"
"Elsa."
"It is nice to meet you, Elsa. Now I must go back out to help."
"I'm coming with you."
"There's no need. Get warm. Stay with your children."
"Those are my people, Jack. I'm going to help them."
He didn't argue.
"I will meet you downstairs."
Elsa went into the bathroom, saw her children in the shower together, fully dressed, laughing. She said,
"I'm going to help Jack and his friends, Loretta. You guys get some sleep."
Loretta said,
"I'll come."
"No, I need you to watch Aunt and get warm. Please, no fighting with me."
Elsa hurried back outside. Now there were several automobiles in the parking lot with their lights on. Volunteers gathered in a semicircle around Jack, who was clearly their leader.
"Back to the ditch bank camp off of Sutter Road. We need to save as many of them as we can. The Grange Hall has room, and so do the depot and the barns at the fairground."
Elsa climbed into Jack's truck. They joined a steady stream of blurred yellow headlights in the falling rain. Jack leaned sideways, grabbed a ratty brown sack from behind Elsa's seat.
"Here, put these on."
He dropped the bag in her lap. Fingers shaking with cold, she opened it, found a pair of men's pants and a flannel shirt, both huge.
"I have something to tie the pants tight," he said.
He pulled off to the side of the road at the destroyed encampment. Drenched, dislocated people walked toward the road, clutching whatever they'd been able to save. In the darkness beside the truck, Elsa stripped out of her wet dress and into the oversized flannel shirt, and then put on the pants. Her journal fell out of her bodice, surprising her. She'd forgotten she'd saved it. She set it on the truck seat, then stepped back into her wet galoshes and out into the rushing water. Jack yanked off his tie and fit it through the belt loops on her borrowed pants, cinching the waistband tightly. Then he took off his coat and put it around her shoulders. Elsa was too cold to be polite. She put on the coat, buttoned it up.
"Thank you."
He took her by the hand.
"The water is still rising. Be careful."
Elsa held on to his hand as they slogged through the cold, muddy, rising water. Ruined belongings floated past them. She saw a broken-down truck with a pile of junk tarped in the back, and a face.
"There!"
she yelled to Jack, pointed.
"We're here to help!"
Jack shouted. The black, shiny tarp slowly lifted. Huddled beneath it, Elsa saw, was a bony woman in a wet dress holding a toddler. Both her face and the toddler's were blue with cold.
"Let us help you,"
Jack said, reaching out. The woman pushed the tarp aside and crawled forward, holding her child close. Elsa immediately put an arm around the woman, felt how thin she was. At the side of the road, volunteers, more now, were waiting with umbrellas and raincoats and blankets and hot coffee.
"Thank you,"
the woman said. Elsa nodded and turned back to Jack. Together, they trudged back to the camp. Water and wind beat at them. Mud filled Elsa's boots with cold. They worked through the long, wet night. Along with the rest of the volunteers, they helped people get away from the flooded encampment. They took as many as they could to warmth, got them settled in whatever buildings they could find. By 6 in the morning, the rain and the flooding had stopped, and dawn revealed the devastation caused by the flash flood. The ditch bank camp had been washed away. Belongings floated in the water. Tents lay in tangled masses, ruined. Sheets of cardboard and metal lay scattered, as did boxes and buckets and quilts.
Jalopies were up to their fenders in water and mud, trapped in place. Elsa stood by the side of the road, staring at the flooded land. People like her, who had almost nothing, had lost everything. Jack came up beside Elsa and wrapped a blanket around her shoulders.
You are dead on your feet.
She pushed the wet hair out of her eyes. Her hand trembled at the effort.
I'm fine.
Jack said something. She heard his voice, but the vowels and consonants were stretched out of shape. She started to say, I'm fine again, but the lie got lost somewhere between her brain and her tongue.
Elsa!
She stared at him, uncomprehending. Oh, wait. I'm falling. Elsa wakened in Jack's truck as it rattled to a stop in front of the boarded-up hotel. Elsa sat up, feeling dizzy. She saw her journal on the seat beside her and picked it up. The parking area was crowded with people now. It had become a disaster staging area. Volunteers offered food and hot coffee and clothes to the flood victims, who walked around with a dazed look. Elsa got out of the truck, staggered sideways. Jack was there to catch her. She tried to pull away.
I should go to see my children.
They're probably still sleeping. I'll make sure they're fine and tell them where you are. For now, though, you are getting some sleep. I saved a room for you.
Sleep. She had to admit it sounded good. He helped her up the stairs and into the room next to her children's. Once inside, he led her straight into the bathroom, where he turned on the shower water and waited impatiently for it to get warm. When it did, he wrenched back the curtain. Elsa couldn't hold back a sigh. Warm water. She tossed her journal onto a shelf above the toilet. Before she fully understood what he was doing, Jack had removed her galoshes and peeled the heavy canvas duster off of her and pushed her into the spray of water, fully dressed. Elsa tilted her head back, let the hot water run through her hair. Jack pulled the shower curtain shut and left her. The water at Elsa's feet turned black with mud. She stripped out of Jack's clothes, probably ruined now, and reached for the soap in the dish and rubbed it in her hands. Lavender. She washed her hair and scrubbed her skin until it tingled. When the water began to cool, she stepped out, dried off, and wrapped herself in the towel. Steam hung in the room. She washed Jack's clothes in the sink, then draped the shirt and pants and her undergarments and socks over the towel rack and returned to the bedroom. Clean sheets. What a luxury. Maybe Jack was right. A short nap might help. Elsa thought of all the laundry she'd done in her life, the joy she'd always taken in hanging sheets to dry. But never until now had she fully, deeply appreciated the sheer physical pleasure of clean sheets on naked skin, the fresh smell of lavender soap in her hair. She rolled onto her side and closed her eyes. Within moments, she was asleep. 27. When Loretta woke up, she didn't know where she was. She sat up slowly, feeling a cloud-soft mattress beneath her. Hair lay across her face in tangles. It smelled of lavender. Mom's soap. But it wasn't quite the right aroma, and they hadn't had lavender soap in years. The flood. The ditch bank camp. It came back to her in a flash, the muddy water rushing past them, the tent collapsing, people screaming. Loretta eased out from underneath the covers and found Ant curled up beside her, wearing only his saggy underwear and an undershirt. Their slightly damp clothes hung from hooks on a wooden dresser. Loretta got up and took her clothes with her into the bathroom. After she used the toilet, she couldn't help herself. She took another shower, but didn't wash her hair. Then she put on her dress and sweater. Her coat was gone, as was all of their money and food.
Oh, no, you don't,
Aunt said, flinging the covers aside when she walked back into the room barefoot.
What do you mean? You ain't leaving me here alone. I'm not a baby anymore. I'm starting to think things happen that I don't know nothing about.
Loretta couldn't help smiling.
Get dressed, Ansie.
He dressed in last night's still damp clothes, all they had left now, and together they left the room, walked on bare feet down the narrow stairway to the lobby below. Halfway down, they heard voices. The small lobby was filled with people. The air smelled of sweat, wet clothes, and drying mud. Loretta and Aunt pushed their way through. Outside, a bright sun shone on the wet street, which had been cordoned off to traffic. Several organizations had set up tents in the street, the Red Cross and the Salvation Army, some state relief organizations, a couple of church groups. Each held a table and chairs, along with donuts and sandwiches and hot coffee, as well as boxes of goods and clothes for giveaway.
It's like a carnival,
Aunt said, shivering in his damp clothes.
But I don't see no rides.
Any rides, Loretta said, crossing her arms for warmth. The displaced migrant families were obvious. They gathered in bedraggled groups, wearing blankets and looking dazed, sipping hot coffee. Loretta saw a tent set back from the others. A banner hung from one tent pole to the other. Workers' Alliance, FDR's New Deal should work for you. Communists.
Come on.
Loretta dragged Aunt to the tent, where a woman in a black coat stood all by herself smoking a cigarette. She wore black wool pants and a creamy white sweater and a beret. Bright red lipstick accentuated the pallor of her skin. Loretta approached the tent.
Hello?
The woman pulled the cigarette from her bright red lips and turned. Her dark eyes narrowed into an assessing gaze that swept Loretta from head to foot.
Would you like some coffee?
Loretta had never seen a woman like this. So elegant. Or maybe it was just boldness. She was probably Mom's age, but her style and beauty were somehow ageless.
I'm Loretta.
The woman extended a hand. Bright red lacquer polish brightened her short fingernails.
I'm Natalia. You're freezing.
Wet clothes. But that doesn't matter. I want to join your group.
The woman took a drag of her cigarette, exhaled slowly.
Really?
I know Mr. Vallon. I have been to a barn meeting.
Really?
I'd like to join the fight.
Natalia paused.
Well, I imagine you have more reason than most. Today, though, we are not fighting. Today, we are helping.
Helping people gets their attention.
Smart girl.
I want to be a part of...
She lowered her voice.
You know, rise up. Stand up.
Natalia nodded.
Good for you. A girl who thinks for herself. You can start by getting some dry clothes and shoes for you and the boy. Put them on. Stop shivering. Then you may help me pour coffee.
Volunteers arrived in a steady stream. By noon, there were hundreds of people in the valley, handing out hot coffee and warm clothes and sandwiches. The Red Cross had set up a temporary shelter in an abandoned automobile dealership and given folks a place to stay overnight. The Salvation Army had taken over the local Grange Hall. According to Jack, half the communists and socialists in Hollywood had come to help or sent donations. There was even word that some movie stars were here, although Loretta hadn't seen any. Or maybe Natalia was an actress. She certainly had the glamour. Loretta and Aunt had spent the last few hours helping flood victims in any way they could. Loretta had found dry, warm clothes and shoes for the three of them. The clothing, their only real belongings now, sat in a box in the communists' tent. She found a dress and sweater for Mom and had taken them up to her room. Seeing Mom asleep, Loretta had left the clothes for her. Now Loretta sat in the communists' tent beside Natalia. In front of them, the table held a big metal coffee pot and a nearly empty tray of sandwiches, and a stack of flyers, very few of which had been taken, if any. Natalia lit up a cigarette, offered Loretta one.
No, thanks. I'd rather eat than smoke.
Natalia leaned forward and took the last bologna sandwich, handing it to Loretta. Taking a bite, Loretta stared out at the diminished crowd. There were fewer people out here now. Most had been relocated or helped in some way. Out in the cordoned-off street, Jack threw a softball back and forth with Ant. Loretta found herself mesmerized by Ant's joy in such a simple thing. It made her think about Daddy and who they'd all been before he left. His leaving was still the worst thing that had happened to their family. The drought and the depression would end. Daddy leaving them in the middle of it would hurt forever. She looked at Jack. Even with all they'd been through, the long, terrible night, there was a strength in him that comforted her. You could count on a man like that, she thought. A man who didn't just spout ideas, but fought for them, took beatings for them, and stayed in place. If only her father had been more like Jack. A rebel instead of a dreamer. Daddy had given Loretta words. It was actions that mattered. She knew that now. Leaving, staying, fighting, or walking away. Loretta wanted to be like Jack, not like her faithless father. She wanted to stand for something and tell the world she was better than this, that America should be better than letting her live this way. But look at the stack of flyers left on the table. Very few had been taken. People had taken coffee and sandwiches, but apparently they didn't want words, especially not fighting words. And the only name on the Workers' Alliance sign-up sheet was Loretta's.
How do you know Jack?
Loretta said, looking at him.
I met him years ago at a John Reed club. We were both young and full of ourselves.
Natalia dropped her cigarette and stubbed it out with her fashionable shoe.
He was the first person I know to start talking about workers' rights in the fields. He got us to fight the deportation of Mexicans a few years ago. It was an ugly time, but...
She shrugged.
People get scared when they lose their jobs, and they tend to blame outsiders. The first step is to call them criminals. The rest is easy. You know about that, she said, eyeing Loretta.
I do.
Several years ago, the Mexicans organized and joined the union and struck for better wages, but it came with violence. Men died. Jack spent a year in San Quentin. When he came out, he was even more determined.
Loretta hadn't considered prison.
How is it illegal to ask for better wages?
Natalia lit up another cigarette.
It isn't, technically. But this is a capitalist country, run by big money interests. After the state's anti-immigration campaign, when they rounded up all the illegals and deported them back to Mexico, the growers would have had a real problem. But then...
We started coming.
Natalia nodded.
They sent flyers across America, telling workers to come. And they came, too many of them. Now there are 10 workers for every job. We're having trouble getting your people to organize. They're...
independent.
I was going to say stubborn.
Yeah. Well, a lot of us are farmers, and you have to be stubborn to survive sometimes.
Are you stubborn?
Yeah,
Loretta said slowly.
I reckon so. But more than anything, I'm mad.
Elsa woke to sunshine coming through glass windows, and it made her miss the farmhouse in Lonesome Tree. She would write about that in her journal later, about the simple joy of seeing sunshine through clean glass, golden, pure as the gaze of God, and how it could lift one's spirit. It was better than writing about the new and terrifying truth of life. Their money was gone. Their belongings, their tent, their stove, their food, gone. Still, someone had left a pale blue dress and a red sweater hanging over the dresser. Small blessings. Moving slowly, everything hurt after last night, she slipped into the new clothes and still muddy galoshes and went to the room next door to find her children. When no one answered her knock on the door, she went downstairs. The street in front of the hotel was cordoned off to traffic. The Red Cross had set up a tent, as had the Salvation Army and a local Presbyterian church. She saw Aunt and Loretta handing out food on trays. The sight of them helping others when they themselves had lost everything made her proud. After all they'd suffered, the hardship, the loss, the disappointment, there they were, smiling and handing out food, helping people. It gave her hope for the future. Jack stood in a nearby tent, talking to a woman in a beret. Elsa headed toward him. He gave her a smile.
Coffee?
I'd love some.
He pulled out a chair for her. She saw stacks of flyers on the table around him. Unionize now. Communism is the new Americanism. Some of the flyers were in Spanish. A sign-up sheet asked for people to join the Workers' Alliance. There was one name on it. Loretta's.
Offering a little radical ideology with the coffee,
she said, crumpling the sign-up sheet into a ball.
My daughter is not signing this.
He sat down near her, scooted closer.
Loretta has been following me around like a bird dog on the scent.
She's 13.
Elsa glanced at the people gathered in the street.
She could get in trouble just talking to you, let alone joining the Communist Party. The growers don't want unions.
A sad comment on the times. This is America, after all.
Not the America I know.
She turned to him.
Why communism?
Why not? I've done my time in the fields. I know how hard life is for migrant workers. Big growers helped elect FDR. He's beholden to them. Ever wonder why his policies help almost all workers except farm workers? I want to make it better.
He looked at her.
I have a feeling you know struggle. Maybe you can tell me why most of the folks coming into this state don't want to unionize.
We're proud, she said. We believe in hard work and a fair chance, not one for all and all for one.
But don't you think a little all for one might help your folks?
I think what you want will cause trouble.
Elsa finished her coffee and handed him her empty cup. As he took it from her, she noticed his ratty wristwatch, which didn't tell the right time. It surprised her, that small insight. She'd never known a man who didn't care about time.
I appreciate your help, Jack, truly. Your people were the first to help us, but...
But what?
I don't have time for communism. I need to find a place for us to live.
You think I don't understand, Mrs. Martinelli, but I do. Better than you can imagine.
The way he said her surname surprised her somehow. He made it sound exotic almost, tinged with an accent she didn't recognize.
Call me Elsa, please.
Will you let me do one thing for you?
What?
Will you trust me?
Why?
There's no why to trust. It either is or isn't. Will you trust me?
Elsa stared at him, looked deeply into his dark eyes. There was in him an intensity that unnerved her. Maybe she would have found him frightening in her life before all of this. She remembered the day she'd seen him proselytizing in the town square and getting punched by the police, and the bruises she'd seen on his face when she saw him outside the police station. He and his ideas came with violence. There was no doubt about that. But he'd saved her children and given them a place to stay, and strangely, beneath the fierceness she saw in him, she sensed pain. Not loneliness, exactly, but an aloneness she recognized. Elsa stood.
Okay, she said, her gaze steady.
He led her to the Red Cross tent, where Loretta and Aunt were handing out sandwiches.
Mommy!
Aunt cried out at the sight of her. Elsa couldn't help smiling. What in the world was more restorative than a child's love?
You should see how good I've been at food, Mommy,
Aunt said, grinning.
And I didn't eat every donut.
Elsa ruffled his clean hair.
I'm proud of you. And now Mr. Vallon promises to show us something interesting. Explorers Club outing?
Yay!
Loretta said,
Let me get our new stuff.
She ran back to the communist tent and returned with a box full of clothes and bedding and food. Jack touched Elsa's arm gently. When she looked up at him, she saw a surprising understanding in his eyes, as if he knew how it felt to lose everything, or maybe just to have nothing to lose.
Follow me. I'm in that truck.
Elsa walked with her children to their own muddy truck and climbed in. The truck bed held the few goods and belongings they'd never unpacked, things they didn't need in this broken-down version of their life. As they headed north following Jack, storm damage was evident everywhere. Splintered, fallen trees, rocks and rubble in the street, slumps of land that covered roadways, water in gullies, in puddles, in falls by the street. People walked in a steady stream along the side of the road, carrying whatever they had left. They passed another ditch bank camp that was destroyed, a sea of mud and belongings, but already people were slogging back onto the wet land, digging through the mud and standing water for their belongings. At a sign that read Welty Farms, Jack pulled over to the side of the road and parked. Elsa did the same. He walked over to her side of the truck. She rolled down the window.
This is Welty's camp. He houses some pickers here. I heard that a family left yesterday.
Why would a family leave?
Someone died, he said. Tell the man at the guardhouse that Grant sent you.
Who is Grant?
A boss. He drinks too much to remember who uses his name.
Will you come with us?
I've got a bad reputation around here. They don't like my ideas.
He flashed her a smile and walked back to his own truck. He was gone before Elsa could thank him. She drove slowly onto Welty land, noticing that it was soggy from rain but hadn't been flooded. The camp was situated between two cotton fields and set well back from the road. A guardhouse stood at the fenced entrance to the camp. Elsa came to it and stopped. A man stood there holding a shotgun. He was whippet thin, with a pencil neck and an elbow-sharp chin. A hat covered close-cut gray hair.
Hello, sir, she said.
The man stepped up to the truck, peered inside.
You flooded out?
Yes, sir.
We only take families here, he said. No riffraff, no Negroes, no Mexicans.
He eyed the three of them.
No single women.
My husband is coming home tomorrow, Elsa said. He's picking peas.
She paused.
Grant sent us.
Yep, he knows I've got an open cabin.
A cabin?
Loretta whispered.
It's $4 a month for electricity and $1 apiece for two mattresses.
$6, Elsa said. Can I get a cabin without electricity or mattresses?
No, ma'am. But there's work here at Welty, and if you live in our cabins, you're the first to get our jobs. The big man owns 22,000 acres of cotton. Most of our folks live on relief until the cotton season. We have our own school, too, and a post office.
School? On the property?
It's better for the kids. They don't get hassled so much. You want it or not?
She definitely wants it,
Aunt said.
Yes, Elsa said.
Cabin 10. We take payment right out of your pay. There's a store where you can buy goods and even get a little cash if you need it. On credit, of course. Go on.
Don't you need my name?
Nah. Go on.
Elsa continued on the muddy road toward a collection of cabins and tents, set up almost like a town. She followed the signs to cabin 10 and parked beside it. The cabin was a concrete and wooden structure that was about 10 feet by 12 feet. The sides began as a layer of concrete block and then became metal panels with wood supports. There were no windows, but two of the upper walls had long metal vents that could be pushed up and locked in place on hot days. They got out of the truck and went inside. It was gloomy, cast in shadows. A bare light bulb hung from a cord on the ceiling.
Electricity, Elsa said, marveling.
A small hot plate on a wooden shelf and two rusted metal bed frames with mattresses took up half of the space in the cabin, but there was room for chairs, maybe even a table. There was a cement floor. A floor.
Wowza, Aunt said. This is great,
Loretta said. Electricity, mattresses, a floor beneath their feet, a roof over their heads. But $6. How in the world could she pay for this? They'd lost every cent they had.
Are you okay, Mom?
Loretta asked.
Can we go exploring?
Aunt asked.
Maybe there's other kids here.
Elsa nodded distractedly, stood there. Go on. Don't be gone long. Elsa left the cabin after them. She could see several cabins and at least 50 tents spread out across 5 or 6 acres. People milled about, gathering firewood, chasing children. It looked more like a town than a ditch bank camp, with signs that pointed the way to toilets and laundry and school. The good fortune of being here was tempered by her fear of losing it. How long could she live on credit? She went back to her truck and picked up the box of supplies Loretta had gathered from the Salvation Army. Clothes, shoes, and coats for the children, sheets, a single frying pan, and some food. Enough for 2 days, if they were careful. What then? She carried it into their cabin and closed the door.
Hey,
Jack said, seated on one of the beds. Elsa almost dropped the box in surprise.
I'm sorry, he said. I didn't mean to scare you. It seems I couldn't stay away.
I thought you weren't supposed to be here.
I have a fondness for breaking rules.
Elsa set the box on the floor and sat down beside him.
I don't know how I'll pay for this. I'm grateful, truly. It's just...
It costs money you don't have.
Yes.
It felt good to say it out loud.
We lost everything in the flood.
I wish I had money to give you, but a job like mine doesn't pay much.
I'm surprised it pays at all.
She looked at him. What is your job exactly?
I work for the Workers' Alliance, the Popular Front, whatever you want to call it.
The Communist Party.
Yes. There are about 40 of us on the payroll across the state. Support in Hollywood is high right now, with what's going on in Europe. I write for the Daily Worker, sign up new members, lead study groups, and organize strikes. Basically, I do whatever I can to help people who are being taken advantage of by the capitalist system. And I spread the word that there's a better way.
He met her gaze and returned it with a steady one of his own.
How did you end up living in that camp? As a single woman.
She tucked her hair behind one ear.
You've heard my story before, believe me. We left bad times in Texas and found it worse in California.
Your husband?
Gone.
So he's a fool.
Elsa smiled. She'd never quite thought of it that way, but she liked it.
That's my position, yes. And you? Are you married?
Nope. Never been. Women tend to be scared of the trouble I bring. The big, bad communist.
Everything is frightening these days. How much more trouble can there be?
I've been in prison,
he said quietly.
Does that scare you?
It would have. Once.
Elsa was unused to the way he stared at her.
I'm not going to get any prettier, you know.
You think that's what I'm thinking when I look at you?
Why do you take the risk? Of communism, I mean. You must know it won't work in America, and I see what it costs you.
For my mother, he said. She came here at 16 because she was starving and had been disowned by her family because of me. I still don't know who my father is. She worked like a dog to support us, doing whatever she had to do, but each night, at bedtime, she kissed me goodnight and told me I could be anything in America. It was the dream that had brought her here, and she passed it on to me, but it was a lie. For people like us, anyway. Folks who are from the wrong place or have the wrong color skin or speak the wrong language or pray to the wrong god. She died in a factory fire. All of the doors were locked to keep the workers from taking cigarette breaks. This country used her up and spit her out, and all she ever wanted was for me to have opportunities. A better life than she'd had. He leaned toward her. You understand. I know you do. Your people are starving, dying. Thousands are homeless. They can't make enough money picking to survive. Help me convince them to strike for better wages. They'll listen to you.
Elsa laughed. No one has ever listened to me.
They will. We need someone like you.
Elsa's smile faded. He was serious. What good is a strike if you lose your job? I have children to feed.
Loretta is a firebrand. She would love...
She needs to be in school. Education is what will give her a better life, not joining the communists.
Elsa got slowly to her feet.
I'm sorry, Jack. I'm not brave enough to help you. And please, please, keep your people away from my daughter.
Jack rose. She could see the disappointment in his eyes.
I understand.
Do you?
Of course. Fear is smart until...
He headed for the door, paused as he reached for the knob.
Until what?
He looked back at her.
Until you realize you're afraid of the wrong thing.
That night, while the children slept, Elsa got her journal out of the box that had been in the truck. She turned through the pages. The children had been right that writing helped. Words jumped out at her. Rain. Baby in a lavender blanket, no work, waiting for cotton, the demoralizing rain. Tonight, later, she would write about her constant fear, how it strangled her all the time, and the constant effort it took not to show it to her children. Writing about it would remind her that they had survived. As bad as the flood had been, they were still here. Although this journal meant the world to her, now, it was the only paper they had. She ripped a sheet out and wrote a letter to Tony and Rose.
Dear Tony and Rose, we have an address. We are, at last, out of our tent and into a home with real walls and a floor. The children are enrolled in a school that is a stone's throw away from our own front door. We feel so blessed. That's the good news. The not-so-good news is that a flood destroyed our tent and most of our belongings. Imagine that, a flood. I know you'd love a little of that water to come your way. Lord, I miss home so much sometimes I can hardly breathe. How is the farm, the town, you both? Please write to us soon. Love, Elsa, Loretta, and Aunt.
28. Last night, they'd eaten a meal that almost filled their bellies and which had been cooked on an electric hot plate inside a cabin with four walls and a roof overhead and a floor to stand upon. After supper, they'd climbed into real beds on real mattresses that weren't on the floor. Loretta had slept deeply, with her little brother tucked in close, and awakened the next morning refreshed. After breakfast, they each dressed in the new garments and shoes they'd gotten from the Salvation Army and stepped outside into a bright, sunlit day. The Welty camp was situated on a few acres tucked in between cotton fields. Although the camp hadn't flooded, evidence of too much rain was everywhere. The grass had been stomped into mud, but Loretta could see it would be a green pasture under better conditions. Now, many of the trees, scattered randomly throughout the camp, were broken-limbed by the storm. Ditches full of muddy water ran here and there. 10 cabins and about 50 tents created a makeshift town in the center of the camp. Between the cabins and the first of the tents, Loretta saw a long building that was the laundry and four restrooms, two for women and two for men, each of which had long lines of people waiting their turn. Most important, there were two faucets at each entrance. Clean water,
No more hauling water from the ditch, boiling and straining it before each use. At the company store, more people waited in line, mostly women, standing with their arms crossed, children close by. A hand-painted sign pointed the way to the school.
What if I said we'd start tomorrow?
Loretta said glumly.
I'd say you were just bumping gums, Mom said. I'm going to do laundry and get some food, and you're going to school. End of story. Start walking.
Aunt giggled.
Mom wins.
Mom led the way toward a pair of tents positioned at the far end of the camp in a grove of spindly trees. She paused beside the largest of the tents, which had a wooden sign posted out front, Little Kids School. The tent next door read, Big Kids School.
I reckon I'm big,
Aunt said. Mom said, I don't think so, and eased Aunt toward the little kids' tent. Loretta moved fast. The last thing she wanted was to be walked into her classroom by her mother. She went to the big kids' tent and peered inside. There were about 5 desks. 2 were empty. A woman wearing a drab gray cotton dress and rubber boots stood at the front of the room. Beside her was an easel that held a chalkboard. On it, she'd written American History. Loretta ducked inside and sat at the empty desk in the back. The teacher looked up.
I'm Mrs. Sharp, and who is our newest pupil?
The other kids turned to look at Loretta.
Loretta Martinelli.
The boy in the next desk scooted so close, his desk edge banged into hers. He was tall, she could tell, lanky, with a dirty cap pulled down so low she couldn't see his eyes. His blonde hair was too long. He wore faded overalls over a denim shirt. One bib strap was untied, and the corner flapped over like a dog's ear. A winter coat hung on him, too big and missing most of the buttons. He pulled off his cap.
Loretta. I ain't heard that name before. It's pretty. Hi, she said. Thanks. And you are? Bobby Rand. You moved into Cabin 10? The Pennypakers left just before the flood. The old man died. Dysentery.
He smiled.
Glad to have someone my age here. My pa makes me go to school if there's no picking. Yeah, my mom wants me to go to college.
He laughed, showing off a missing tooth.
That's rich.
Loretta glared at him.
Girls can go to college, I'll have you know. Oh, I thought you were joking. Well, I'm not. Where are you from, the Stone Age? New Mexico. We had a grocery store that went bust.
Students, the teacher said, rapping a ruler on the top of the easel. You are not here to jaw. Open your American history books to page 112.
Bobby opened a book.
We can share. Not that we're going to learn anything that matters.
Loretta leaned toward him, looked at the open book. The chapter heading was The Founding Fathers and the First Continental Congress. Loretta raised her hand.
Yes, Loretta, is it?
Loretta didn't correct the pronunciation of her name. Mrs. Sharp didn't look like much of a listener.
I'm interested in more recent history, ma'am. The farm workers here in California. The anti-immigration policies that deported the Mexicans. And what about workers' unions? I'd like to understand.
The teacher rapped her ruler down so hard it cracked.
We do not talk about unionism here. That's un-American. We are lucky to have jobs that put food on our tables.
But we don't really have jobs, do we? I mean,
out. Now. Don't come back until you're ready to be grateful. And quiet, as young women should always be.
What is wrong with everyone in this state?
Loretta said, slamming the book shut on Bobby's finger. He yelped in pain.
We don't need to learn about what old rich men did more than 100 years ago. The world is falling apart now.
She strode out of the tent. What now? Loretta marched through the grassy mud toward... what? Where was she going? If she went back to the cabin, Mom would put her to work doing laundry. The library. It was the only thing she could think of. She walked out of camp and turned onto the paved road and walked to town.
In Welty, which was less than a mile away, she turned onto Main Street, where a series of awninged shops had obviously once offered everything a person could need if you had money. Tailors, druggists, grocers, butchers, dress shops. Now most of them were closed. A movie theater stood in the center of town, its marquee unlit, its windows boarded up. She passed a boarded-up hat shop. A man sat on the stoop, one leg stretched out, the other bent. He draped an arm over the bent knee, a brown hand-rolled cigarette dangled between his fingers. He peered up at her from beneath the brim of his tired-looking fedora. A look of understanding passed between them. Loretta paused for a moment outside the library. She hadn't been here since the day of her haircut. It already felt like a lifetime ago. Today she looked bedraggled, unkempt, skinny. At least she was wearing the relatively new hand-me-down dress, but the mud-splattered lace-up shoes and socks were not a good look on anyone. Loretta forced herself to open the door. Once inside, she stepped out of her muddy shoes, left them by the door. The librarian looked Loretta up and down, from her dirty stockinged feet to the ratty lace of her hand-me-down collar. "Remember me, please. Don't call me an Okie."
"Miss Martinelli," she said. "I hoped you'd return. Your mother was so pleased to pick up your library card."
"It was my Christmas present."
"A fine gift."
"I lost the Nancy Drew books in the flood. I'm so sorry."
Mrs. Quistorf gave her a sad smile.
"Nothing to fret about. I'm just glad to see you looking well. What can I find on the shelves for you?"
"I'm interested in workers' rights."
"Ah, politics."
She walked away.
"Give me a moment."
Loretta glanced at the newspapers spread out on the table beside her. One from the Los Angeles Herald Express had the headline, "Stay Away from California, Warning to Transient Hordes."
Nothing new there.
"Relief for migrants to bankrupt state." Loretta flipped through the pages, saw article after article that claimed the migrants were bankrupting the state by demanding aid, called them shiftless and lazy and criminal, reported that they lived like dogs because they don't know any better. She heard footsteps again. Mrs. Quistorf came up beside her and laid a slim book on the table beside the newspapers. 10 Days That Shook the World by John Reed.
"John Reed,"
Loretta said. The name struck a chord, but she couldn't remember where she'd heard it.
"Thank you."
"A warning, though," Mrs. Quistorf said quietly. "Words and ideas can be deadly. You be careful what you say and to whom, especially in this town."
The camp's laundry was housed in a long wooden building and had 6 large metal tubs and 3 hand-cranked wringers, and, miracle of miracles, clean running water at the turn of a handle. Elsa spent her first morning in camp washing the sheets they had gotten from the Salvation Army and the clothes they'd worn in the flood, putting it all through a wringer instead of twisting the water out of each item by hand. When everything was clean, she carried the damp bundle back to her cabin and set up a makeshift laundry line and hung it all to dry. Then she retrieved the letter she'd written last night and dropped it off at the post office. Just that, the fact that she could walk 50 feet and mail a letter, was a staggering bit of good fortune. And now, shopping. Right here, in camp. What a convenience. The company store was in a narrow, green, clapboard building with a peaked roof and slim windows positioned on either side of a white door. She had to walk through mud to get there. Mud everywhere, of course, since the flood and the rain, and climb 2 mud-streaked steps. As Elsa opened the door, a bell tinkled overhead, sounding surprisingly gay. Inside, she saw rows and rows of food. Cans of beans and peas and tomato soup, bags of rice and flour and sugar, smoked meats, locally made cheeses, fresh vegetables, eggs, milk. One whole wall was clothing,
Bolts of fabric, everything from cotton to wool. There were boxes of buttons and ribbons and spools of thread, shoes in every size, galoshes and raincoats and hats. There were cotton and potato-picking sacks and canteens and gloves. Everything was priced high, she noticed. Some things, like eggs, were more than twice the price they were in town. The cotton-picking sacks that hung from hooks on the wall were priced three times what Elsa had paid in town. She picked up an empty basket. In the back of the store, a long counter ran nearly from end to end. Behind it stood a man with mutton-chop sideburns and bushy eyebrows. He wore a dark brown hat, a black sweater, and pants with suspenders.
"Hello there," he said, pushing the wire-rimmed spectacles higher on his nose. "You must be the new resident at Cabin 10.
"I am," Elsa said. "We are, actually, my children and me. And my husband," she remembered to add.
"Welcome. You look like a fine new member of our little community."
"We were flooded out of our home."
"As so many were."
"Our money was lost. All of it."
He nodded. "Indeed. Again, a common tale."
"I have children to feed."
"And rent to pay now."
Elsa swallowed hard. "Yes, your prices, they're very high."
Behind her, the bell tinkled again. She turned and saw a big man walk in. A toothy smile dominated his florid, fleshy face. He hooked his thumbs into the suspenders that held up his brown woolen pants and ambled casually forward, eyeing the goods on either side of him as he walked.
"Mr. Welty," the store clerk said. "A good morning to you."
Welty, the owner.
"It'll be better when the damn ground dries, Harold."
"And who have we here?"
He came to a stop beside Elsa. Up close, she saw the quality of his clothing, the cut of his coat. It was how her father had dressed for work, a man choosing clothes to make a statement.
"Elsa Martinelli," she said. "We are new here."
"The poor family lost everything in the flood," Harold said.
"Ah,"
Mr. Welty said.
"Then you're in the right place. Stock up on food to feed your family. Get whatever suits your fancy. Come cotton season, you will make plenty. Do you have children?"
"Two, sir."
"Fine, fine. We love our children pickers."
He slapped a hand down on the counter hard enough to rattle the jar of candy by the register.
"Give her some candy for her children, by God."
Elsa thanked him, although she was pretty sure he didn't hear or wasn't listening. Already he was turning away, walking out of the store. The bell jangled.
"So," Harold said, opening a book. "Cabin 10. I will put you down for $6 this month on credit. That's for rent. Now what else do you need?"
Elsa looked longingly at the smoked meat.
"Just take what you need,"
Harold said gently. Elsa couldn't do that. If she did, she'd take it all and run like a thief. She couldn't let herself be seduced by the idea of credit. Nothing in this life was free, for migrants most of all. Still. She walked the aisle slowly, adding up every price in her head. She placed items in her basket with great care, as if they might detonate on impact. Cans of milk, smoked ham, a bag of potatoes, a bag of flour, a bag of rice, two tins of chipped beef, a small amount of sugar, a bag of beans, coffee, some laundry and hand soap, toothpaste and toothbrushes, a blanket, two envelopes. She carried the basket to the counter and withdrew the items one by one. As she did so, a terrible sinking feeling filled her, a sense of impending doom. She had never bought anything she couldn't pay for. Sure, the Walcott family had bought things in town on credit, but that had been a convenience. Her father paid his tab promptly, from savings in the bank. The idea of asking for credit when there were no savings to draw upon felt to Elsa like begging.
$11.20,
Harold said,
writing the total down in the book below the heading of Cabin 10. At this rate, Elsa would accrue a lot of debt between now and April 26th, when, hopefully, state relief would give her some help.
You know, she said quietly, I only need one can of chipped beef.
Elsa had no shelving in the cabin, so she stacked the food carefully in the one box they had and tucked it under the bed. She withheld two cans of milk, a pound of coffee, and a bar of soap. Those items she put back in the bag she'd gotten at the store and carried it out of the cabin. She got into her truck and drove south, past the town of Welty, to the ditch bank camp, and parked on the side of the road. The field was a sea of standing water and mud, studded with debris. Goods, tree limbs, sheets of metal lay scattered and floating. With nowhere else to go, people had begun to move back onto the land and set up camp. Elsa saw the Dewey's big farm truck off to the right, half buried in mud. A group of people stood around it. She carried the groceries across the field, her boots pressing down into the squishy mud, standing water lapping across her ankles now and then. Jeb and the boys were busy hammering nails into salvaged sheets of plywood. The two girls sat in the back of the truck, playing with ruined dolls in muddy dresses. A broken chair leaned against the mud-clogged stove they had hauled all the way from Alabama, thinking it would go into a house. They were living in the truck, all six of them. Elsa saw Jeb and waved. He gave her an ashamed look.
Jean's at the ditch.
Elsa's throat was too tight to allow for words, so she nodded and set the groceries down on the broken chair. Saying nothing, she picked her way through the muddy, debris-strewn field to the ditch. Jean was at the bank, trying to draw water into a bucket. Elsa came up quietly behind her, feeling guilty that she'd gotten out of this place and ashamed at how grateful she was for it.
Jean,
she said. Jean turned. In the split second before she smiled, Elsa saw the depth of her friend's despair.
Elsa, Jean said. As you can see, the neighborhood has gone to hell without you.
Elsa didn't feel much like joking.
Nadine? Mitch? Nadine and them moved on. Just started walking. Ain't seen Mitch since the flood.
Jean got slowly to her feet, set the bucket of dirty water down beside her. Elsa approached cautiously, afraid that she might cry. She understood at last what her grandfather had meant when he said, "Pretend to be brave if you have to." She did that now, managed a smile even as she felt the sting of tears.
I hate you being here. I hate it too.
Jean coughed into a dirty handkerchief.
But Jeb is going to rig some kind of structure on the back of the truck, maybe even make us a covered porch. It won't be so bad soon. The land'll dry.
She smiled.
Maybe you'll come back for tea.
Tea? I think we should start drinking gin.
You'll visit, though.
Elsa glimpsed Jean's fear, and it matched her own.
Of course. And you'll let me know if you need me, whenever, day or night. We're in Cabin 10 at Welty's Growers Camp, just up the road. I've brought you food.
Not enough.
Oh, Elsa, how can I thank you? You don't need to thank me. You know that.
Jean picked up her bucket. The two women walked back to the broken-down truck. How would the Deweys follow the crops in the coming months? Elsa didn't know how to leave them here, but there was nothing she could do. She knew that others were even worse off, without even a car to live in.
It will get better, Jean said. Of course it will.
A look passed between them, a knowledge of their shared lie.
We'll drink gin and dance the Charleston like them society girls, Jean said. I always wanted dance lessons. Did I tell you that? As a girl in Montgomery, I begged my mama for lessons.
I've still got two left, Fate. You should have seen me at my wedding. Jeb and me dancing was a terrible thing to see.
Elsa smiled.
It couldn't be worse than Rafe and me.
Someday soon, we will teach each other to dance, Jean. You and me, with music, and we won't care who is watching or what they think, she said. She pulled Jean into a tight hug and found it difficult to let go.
Go on, Jean said. We're fine here.
With a crisp little nod and a wave to the rest of the family, she headed back across the soggy field. She saw her own stove, half buried in mud, lying on its side, the pipe gone. With each breath, she almost cried. Each moment she held it back was a triumph. She found a bucket sticking up from the mud and picked it up and kept walking. Then she found a coffee cup, and she picked that up, too. In Welty, she walked to the gas station and washed out the bucket at the faucet by the pumps. She held her muddy boots under the water, cleaning them, too, and then she put them back on. All the while, she was thinking about her friend, living in a truck in the middle of a sea of mud in the winter.
Elsa?
She shut off the water and turned. Jack stood there, holding a sheaf of papers, flyers, no doubt, urging people to rise up in anger about the way they were treated. She shouldn't move toward him, not right out here in public, but she couldn't help herself. She felt fragile and alone, so alone.
Are you okay?
He asked, meeting her more than halfway.
I've been out to the ditch bank camp. Jean and the children are living.
On that, her voice broke. Jack opened his arms and she walked into his embrace. He held her close, said nothing while she cried. Even so, his arms comforted her. His shirt soaked up her tears. Finally, she drew back, looked at him. He let her go and wiped the tears from her face with the pad of his thumb.
That's no way to live,
she said, clearing her throat. Already, the moment of intimacy between them was dissolving. She felt embarrassed for letting him hold her. No doubt he thought her needy and pathetic.
No, it isn't. Let me drive you home.
Back to Texas.
Is that what you want?
Jack, what I want doesn't matter one whit, not even to me.
She wiped her eyes, ashamed by the weakness she'd revealed.
It's not weak, you know, to feel things deeply, to want things, to need.
Elsa was startled by his perceptiveness.
I need to go, she said. The kids will be out of school soon.
Goodbye, Elsa.
She was surprised by how sad he looked when he said it, or maybe disappointed in her. It was probably that.
Goodbye, Jack,
she said, and walked away, left him standing there. Somehow, she knew he was staring after her, but she didn't look back. By the end of March, the ground had dried, the ditch bank camp had filled again, Loretta had turned 14, and the Martinelli family was deeply in debt. Elsa did the math obsessively in her head. So far, she and Loretta would have to pick 3,000 pounds of cotton just to pay their debt, but she still had to pay rent and buy food. It was a violent, vicious cycle that would start all over again when winter came. There was no way to get ahead, no way to get out. Still, she went out each day looking for work while the kids were in school. On good days, she made 40 cents weeding or doing someone's laundry or cleaning someone's house. She and the kids made weekly visits to the Salvation Army to pick through the giveaway clothing bins. In April, she counted down the days until she officially became a resident of the state and could qualify for relief. It no longer even crossed her mind to refuse aid from the government. On the appointed day, she woke early and made flour and water pancakes for the kids and poured them each a half glass of the watered-down apple juice they sold by the quart in the company store.
Still sleepy-eyed, the kids dressed and put on their shoes and filed out of the small cabin and headed for the bathrooms, where there would be a long line. When they returned, Elsa served them two pancakes each, doctored with a precious dollop of jam. They sat on their bed, side by side.
"You need to eat something, Mom,"
Loretta said. For a moment, Elsa saw her 14-year-old daughter in heartbreaking relief. Bony face, prominent cheekbones, a gingham dress hung on her thin body, her clavicles stuck up from the hollowed-out skin on either side. She was supposed to be going to square dances and having her first crush on a boy at this age.
"Mom,"